Welcome to a concert series called And Now the Music. Music is one of those elements in life that is universal, like a smile. It's felt in your soul, it brings joy, and it heals. Musicians worldwide are missing ways to express their talents. So we are providing a platform for them and a performance for your enjoyment. Let's show our appreciation by supporting this studio concert series. And now here's your host, Liz Huff.
Hi, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of And Now the Music. Today in the studio, I have with me Ariel Clayton Karras, violin. She's nodding. I am so happy she's here. You are in for a treat today. We also have in studio Nate Lockwood behind the camera, and he can't see him, but he's, you know, he's smiling and waving underneath his mask. And then in the control room, we have, of course, Bruce Gigax. We are here in audio recording studio, and he's in the control room making all the lovely sounds happen, or at least making them sound beautiful. I guess we're making them happen here in the studio, right? So, Ariel kindly agreed to join us today, and she has brought a wealth of wonderful music and experience to share. And I think we're going to start with something called Meditation from Thais. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes. So first of all, thank you so much for having me. And thank you, Nate and Bruce. This is a treat to be here. It's been a while since I've been in this studio, and it's magical. So Meditation from Thais is a very special piece to me. I have played hundreds and hundreds of weddings now in my career as a musician and private events and special occasions. And this is the piece I learned for the very first wedding I ever played when I was 16. And so it entered my repertoire early. That's quite a famous piece of music. It was written for solo violin and orchestra for an opera called Thais by the French composer Jules Massenet. It's a 19th century work. There's a moment in the opera where all the drama stops and there's this musical interlude of the violin with orchestra. And that's what this is. It's about 5 minutes long. And it's a piece I come back to at really important moments in my life. And it's like you don't ever want to ask a chef what their favorite food is. But if you were to ask me what my favorite piece of music is, I have to say this. I love all sorts of pieces of music, but this is like that one piece that kind of is my career in a nutshell. I've played it probably more than any other piece. And for celebratory moments and moments of mourning and everything in between. So I'm excited to kick it off with that now. So here we go with the Meditation from Thais by the French composer Jules Massenet.
Thank you. try not to clap too loud.
Thank you.
It's amazing. Thank you, Ariel.
Yeah.
Wow, I do feel just like...
Yeah, now I feel like I'm here.
It's interesting how, for musicians, the act of making music kind of puts you more present in your body, more fully in your body in some ways.
Yeah, I think one of the things I know... It sort of gets in the way with recordings, actually. So Bruce probably hears it in there, is I breathe very deeply when I play. Mm-hmm. And I can sometimes breathe a little too loud for when I'm in these sorts of spaces. But I'm someone who carries a lot of stress around with me, and I'm very, like, high-functioning, lots of stuff going on. Well, when I play, it forces my body just involuntarily to take in more oxygen. And that's always, like, one of the things I notice is how deeply I'm, like... You know, mm-hmm. inhaling. Yeah. And I have to make a conscious effort not to do it loudly when I'm recording. But, you know, if that makes it into these, you know, today's podcast, I don't care if you hear me breathe.
No, I think it's part of the thing. I was actually marveling. It's so quiet in here. You can hear that the undercurrent of just the bow meeting the strings, which I think is really cool.
Mm-hmm.
Not the sound, but there's that... Mm-hmm. I don't know what to call that, but it's like, yeah, it's a real strings being played.
Oh, also yeah. Brand spanking new strings
yeah,
being
right.
played. They're still stretching, but that's okay. Yeah.
Actually, because some people that are listening to this are not musicians at all, can mm-hmm. you explain to them what that means?
With the new
strings? To put new strings on, what happens?
Yeah, well, you unravel the pegs, and, you know, you slide them in at the top of the peg box, and you wind them up just like you would with a guitar. They meet down on the tailpiece. The three lower strings fit into little holes, and then my top E string has a little loop. It hooks into a hook that's connected to a screw. The E string's very sensitive, so you want to turn it with finer adjustments, so that's why you put it with a screw. But the rest of them, I adjust with pegs. And, you know, I change my strings. I always joke. I change them with the seasons, you mm-hmm. know, spring, summer. Like, it's like almost each new season, it's like time for new strings. My last strings, though, I really let them go a little bit longer than I should have. And so they were super dead. And when you're a busy performer, it's like there's never a good time to change them because you're playing every day of the week for something. So you have to sort of pick and choose when, mm-hmm. okay, I'm going to have to change them the day before the podcast. And, you know, they're yeah. going to stretch, you know. Anyway, it's all good. But it's a good Zen moment to change my strings. And you sit down, cup of coffee, you know, I get rubbing alcohol out to clean my fingerboard, and I'm super OCD about oil on my hands. You wash so just getting all the grime off from those 3 months you played on, you know, sweat and all the dirt, and uh-huh. then like fresh start. So
nice. It's almost winter solstice, so that kind of
mm-hmm.
that's kind of cool.
Yeah, I figured I was like, okay, I'll change them right at the start of winter, basically. So
nice.
They'll last hopefully until there's a vaccine out, right? So.
We will think hopeful thoughts.
Yes, exactly.
So I wanted to ask you, so you're here today as a soloist, but you started a group called Opus 216. How many years ago was that?
Well, it was officially founded with that name in 2012.
Okay.
But we, as a collective, as like someone contracting this ensemble doing work in Northeast Ohio, we've been operating for about 12 years, since 2008. In 2012, the Cleveland Museum of Art had finished their big renovation of the Ames Atrium when they finished their huge completion of that gigantic project, and they had their first big social event in the atrium. It was called the Mix Social Series, and now it's like this ongoing thing, obviously kind of different during the pandemic, but for that first event, they wanted a chamber orchestra. It was a masquerade ball theme, and I was contacted to put it together. And at that point, I had been creating, you know, ensembles for various events in Northeast Ohio, but I hadn't really incorporated myself. And Tom Welsh, amazing director of performing arts over there, was like, we need a name for this. We have to market it. You've got to give me a name. And so I always joke that Tom made me come up with the name. My husband, actually, we were dating at the time, my boyfriend at the time, helped me kind of come up with Opus 216 one night. And it made sense. You know, an opus is a collection, a body of work in music. And we're sort of this modular. I always say we're modular. We can be solo, duo, trio, quartet, quintet, sextet, octet, 12 of us, you know, 30 of us. It just depends on what people want. And then, you know, 216 for the zip code, area code.
Area code, yes.
And it's so funny because sometimes even here, I always think that's like an obvious thing. But when people are introducing us, for instance, at a festival or a community concert, it's like, we'd like to welcome Opus 216. And I'm like, oh, man, it wasn't clear enough. It's the area code, you know. So I'm always very, very kind about it. It's Opus 216, but all good, you know. Yeah. So we have a lot of fun. And we've done, you know, in a normal year, we do about 200 events. Last year, we did 90 weddings and private events, and then a number of other things, both myself as a soloist and with the ensemble. And, you know, during the pandemic, it's all looked a little different. But we've had a remarkably full year, and I'm very, very grateful.
That's fantastic. And thank you for sharing that. And because I'm trying to think, we met, I think, sort of because of the CIM Alumni Association.
Yep, that's, also how we got to know each other.
Way back when. Which I'm very grateful for, because there's a lot of interesting work there, and having some of those similar experiences in conservatory to share and kind of help the next generations coming along, which I know you do a lot. We'll get to more of that as a freelancer and advising
people. You and I met, well, we got to know each other more directly when we were both on the board of directors for the Alumni Association, which no longer exists. But earlier this year, right before the pandemic, I was brought on to CIM's staff as the career advisor.
Yeah.
So it's purely like I'm not a 48-hour a week staff employee, but I'm on call for students with advising needs, and I'm helping to contribute to sort of how they're steering some of the programming towards career opportunities, career development, entrepreneurship, all the things I'm really passionate about, because obviously you don't get a music education in a vacuum and then suddenly get out and voila, your career. they sort of all happen at the same time. And while I was a student, I began working, and I made the choice to stay in Cleveland and set my roots. But for even the students who go beyond, you know, just providing support and resources while they're in the building and then again while they're out is so critical. So, you know, it's, again, I keep saying, like, I was literally on board for 2.5 weeks before the building closed.
Oh my goodness.
So I still kind of feel like this first year on staff has been unusual for me, and I miss the opportunity to meet a lot of students face to face. I've met them all in Zoom and FaceTime advising appointments and, you know, virtually, and as a result, it's been hard to get to know them, but I'm so just optimistic and excited about continuing to build those relationships. It's been fun.
Well, you are providing a wonderful resource. I mean, I know you've been doing that sort of ad hoc with seemingly anyone who contacts you. I don't know how you have the time and energy for that, but thank you.
No, it's all good.
And because you know, you have the depth and breadth of experience and knowledge about what it means to be a freelancer and the types of careers that are available to people. So it's a really wonderful resource, and I'm very glad they brought you on board. So yay.
Well, and I'll sort of steer this in a different direction really quickly. I really like, I like that you're using the word freelancer, because I dislike that word, and it makes me, but it makes me, it gives me an opportunity to not dislike, but I choose not to use that for my career. And I love talking about why. It's an important point I like to make, is that I sort of call it the F word with music. That a lot of times, well, I'll just say this. I try to use the term independent music professional or independent professional.
I like that. I'll have to start using that.
You know, there's a story for why I decided to use that term. But really, I feel like I encounter in my career navigating this independent world as an artist, that I find there are many people who are like sort of knowledgeable about what it means to be a classically trained musician and find your own way, quote unquote, and they get it. And then, for instance, I was once performing for RTA downtown at Terminal Tower in the lobby of the RTA transit stop. And someone came by and, you know, gave a dollar, you know, because they, you know, you can accept tips there. And I'm always happy to do that. And someone said, "Oh, you sound so great." I said, "Thank you." And he said, "Well, what is it you really want to be doing?" And he, you know, but I just looked at him and I said, "I'm doing it. I'm doing what I love." And I think there's this point where as an artist, you want to not like try to prove yourself with your career, but to just approach your career with the same dignity as if it, I mean, because it's my lifelong choice.
Yeah.
And I always say to students and musicians, like, whether it's for 3 weeks or 3 hours or 3 years or 30 years, everyone's going to work for themselves at some point. It's just a matter of, do you want to do it well? Do you want to sort of throw it together and hang on by your fingernails, you know? And so, so I avoid the word freelance only because I think in certain circles, it still is sort of used as this derogatory term for like a second choice or like, well, this isn't really what I want to be doing.
Yeah.
And for me, that's not the case. So I love that you used it because I was able to say, I was able to speak this piece about it.
Well, so. I love that point of view because having gone through the opera program, you know, there's a similar, like, well, if you're not doing straight up opera mm-hmm. or whatever the thing is, like, are you really succeeding? But then on the other hand, one of my teachers said, you have to define what success looks like for you.
Mm-hmm.
Don't let anybody else do it. You need to decide. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, I can do that? Yeah. Okay. All right. I can do that. We are doing that. Here we are.
Absolutely. You know, and I've been a musician in residence at Cleveland Clinic's main campus for over 10 years, and I've done over 500 performances there. And I often get asked there in that program where I've had to go through training to be sort of unsupervised as an artist in the hospital and navigate some of those public spaces. And I've got my little badge with my name, and people will say, oh, this is so great. You know, are you volunteered? No, I'm a paid professional. This is a program. Oh, so are you in the orchestra? I say, no, I actually work for myself, which is even more fun because I get to choose what I do. I mean, not that I don't think, you know, I'm not mm-hmm. trying to qualify an orchestral career, but I'm saying for myself, mm-hmm. success looked different. It looks like something different that I wanted to do for myself. So, yeah, I always want to give grace in those conversations. I'm not trying to make people feel bad if they assume something that it's not or use a term that it's mm-hmm. not to me or whatever, but it's like, it's been a really fun way to try to bring about awareness that what I do, what we do, people like us, matters just as much.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you. I love that. All right. So then let's talk about some of the other things you do. You play Irish fiddle.
Yeah, I do.
Right. I think maybe now would be a good time to pick one and tell our listeners about the piece.
Yeah. Okay, cool. I think the piece I'll play, you know, I was driving over here and I was thinking it would be different, but I think in this moment I want to play a piece called The Banshee. It's a reel and it's really fun. A banshee in Gaelic culture is this sort of wailing female spirit that kind of forebodes something ominous. Usually it'll kind of sweep through a house before someone dies or something. And so it's sort of got this dark quality to it. Mm-hmm. But I always love this piece because it's called The Banshee, but it's actually really bright and happy. And that's sort of like the dichotomy of some Irish fiddle sometimes,
oh, yeah.
You know. So anyway, I'll play a little bit of The Banshee now. Oh, hold on, man. I thought they would stay. Right, they're a little high, but it's fine. It's fiddle. There's a little grace there now. All right, here we go.
I love Irish music. I'm part Irish myself.
Oh.
I don't know if we've had this conversation
before.
That.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, so I'm very drawn to that kind of music. But it's a lovely spirit in that song, too, which is an accidental pun, I suppose, if we're talking about the Banshee.
Right, the Banshee, right? yeah, it's so fun. I mean, and I wish in, like, a different setting I could have brought my whole ensemble in here. It's so much more fun to play that stuff when you've got the string bass pumping and our cellist jamming and the other violinist chopping. It's really super fun.
Hopefully
you get a little
We'll make a date
taste.
For maybe a year in the future and we'll have that happen.
Yeah. Yes, all those post-COVID parties of just like totally excessive plans for all making. Right.
How did you get 100 people in there? Whoa.
Because we can.
Right. We just wanted to. So how did you get into doing the fiddle stuff versus the straight up like classical
violin? Oh, it's
violin?
A totally unromantic story.
Okay.
But I tell it. I bought a book of fiddle tunes on Amazon one year so that I could have a few in my back pocket for a St. Patrick's Day gig. And it wasn't even like an overtly like, please come play Irish fiddle on St. Patrick's Day. It was just a gig I was going to play on St. Patrick's Day. So I thought, oh, it'll be appropriate. I'll learn a few. And oh my gosh, it was this Pandora's box. I was completely in love. Every tune I played, I wanted to learn the next one. And then we found, especially during the pandemic this summer when we were doing our front yard concerts, which I'm sure we'll get into here in a minute, that this was just like one of the most, I mean, people would, my one of the violinists in our ensemble got mad at me one day because he was like, I was shopping at the grocery store and someone asked me if I play in that Irish band. But we're not an Irish band, Ariel. We're Opus 216. I was like, I know, but people like the Irish music. Like, get over it. You know, anyway. So, So it's just been this unexpected love. Like, literally, I bought, you know, the Irish Fiddle Player, the Mel Bay Publishing Company on Amazon, and it's a great book. And the other thing I like about it is that with each tune, it gives that background. So that's why I know that history of the banshee. You know, I'm not an ethnomusicologist. I haven't studied the genre deeply. And so just having a book that kind of gives me some context as I go along and learn, it's like I feel like I could get up and speak a little bit about it.
Yeah. Clearly.
Yeah. So
what, so if you're asked to do another one, which I'm going to right now, what else pops into mind right away from,
maybe something a little bit of a different vibe. I could do the Star of the County Down.
Oh, I love that.
Okay. Yes, yeah. Please. It's a classic, County Down in Ireland. This one, my favorite version of this, Van Morrison did an album with the Chieftains.
Yes.
That like my husband turned me on to on like road trips. It would always be playing. And then, so then when I found this tune in our book, I was very excited to learn it and play it. So I always think of, I mean, they do it justice, obviously. But I'll play it two ways. I'll start with, like, the traditional tune, and then there's, like, sort of a waltz version of it I'll go right into.
Oh, cool.
All right, close enough for Irish fiddle. Tune.
Yes, I also have that CD, which I've listened to.
Yeah, it's so good. It's so good.
There's just something, if you want to get out and like dance, you know, just sort of like around the kitchen kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. There's so many things I could ask you about and or ask you to play, and I'm not even sure where to go next. I know you do some improvisation.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Tell me about your history with improvisation and how you got into that.
Oh, I am not experienced in the sense that, like, I see some of my colleagues and even some of my ensemble members who are really just experts. And not experts. And by expert at improvisation, that's, like, almost an oxymoron to say. but they are so comfortable with themselves and their instruments that it mm-hmm. makes me want to be that way. And, you know, improvising, for anyone listening in who, you know, I mean, you can get the idea, obviously, from the name. You're performing on the spot. You're creating on the spot. We started to use the term soundscapes for some of the ways that we would improvise early on, because there's lots of ways you can improvise. You can use experimental and extended techniques to create sort of these atmospheric sounds or lots of dissonance, or you can keep it in like the super tonal kind of resonant world. And I sort of like more of that with some of the other textures thrown in, but we started to do improvising at our events as a way to sort of give people a brain break from, let's say we were talking about Mozart or we were doing like some big heavy genre, and we'd say, you know what, we're just going to take 3 minutes and one of us is going to lay down some sort of pulse, like a framework. Again, I really like doing it metrically with some mm-hmm. sort of structure, not total freeform, although that's awesome too, and I've done that. But yeah, what we like to do with our soundscapes is like someone lays down some sort of framework we all can build on. Maybe we pick a key and we say 4-4 or 3-4 or 5-4, and we kind of go to town, and we can kind of, one thing we learned was sort of to let someone go first and have their say, and then to kind of, again, build on it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just everyone doing whatever they want at all times. Like, that gets kind of crazy. I was an artist in residence in Gordon Square Arts District over on the West Side in 2018. And as part of my project, I wanted to do a soundscape in the pedestrian tunnel that connected our neighborhood to Edgewater Park, mm-hmm. where the beach is. And so there's this big, long concrete tunnel. And I'd always walked through it thinking, oh, it'd be so fun to play in here.
Yeah.
You know, acoustically, and people coming in and out. Like, how cool would that be? So I got 5 of us and like lined us up every 10 feet or so in this huge tunnel. And I had a cellist on each end where they could sort of be safely away from people more, since they're sitting and take up more feet. And we'd have one of the cellists on either end of the tunnel start, and like one by one, we'd all kind of join in. And then you could kind of get to the other end and you'd hear someone change, and we'd kind of try to carry it back.
Oh, that's so cool.
So then it was super fun. And that was what kind of got us into like, well, let's make this something we do more often. So yeah, so it's fun. And again, doing it solo, I'm happy to do a little bit now. It's not quite the same.
Mm-hmm.
But even when I'm performing sometimes, it really comes in handy, especially, for instance, at this time of year, when you play a lot of holiday music, carols are all so similar.
Mm-hmm.
They're all usually in roughly the same key with the same chord structure. Someone will request something, but then I'll accidentally start playing a different carol or something. And then uh-huh. about halfway through, you sort of realize it. And I would sort of use some of these techniques to like, get myself back to the song that they wanted. You uh-huh. know, Angels We Have Heard on High and Hark the Herald Angels Sing.
Uh-huh.
You can basically play them on top of each other.
Yeah.
You know, so anyway, but I'll do a little improvisation now. All right. Like G major is sort of my home key. It's mm-hmm. like you're like, oh, this seems right. You can play around a lot on the violin and mm-hmm. not get into too much trouble if you haven't already been playing for 3 hours that day and super warmed up. And I always like to pick sort of an interval to start with.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, syncopation comes in handy. And so you just kind of...
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a really sprightly rhythm center to that.
Yeah, well, and I figure by myself,
yeah.
But by yourself, you want to do it with sort of a different energy
yeah.
than to do it with a group and to maybe build on something more lyrical or slow. It's hard to keep the sonic focus
uh-huh.
if you're going very slowly improvising while you're,
yes.
you know, by yourself. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, as a singer, I could.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
Since I can only generally emit one pitch at a time, I can
naturally. Yeah, right. Because there's that kind of singing you can do.
Yeah, too. I don't know how to do that. Yeah. I wish I could. That's, you know, crazy. Like, or the whistle sing thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that's not my jam. I love listening to it, but I don't know how.
Yeah,
I don't know how they do it. So, are there any other classical pieces you'd like to share with the listening audience?
Yeah, I haven't even thought about that today. Well, you know, I can play a piece that I always steal from cellists.
Nice.
It's the Carnival of the Animals excerpt by Camille Saint-Saëns, who's a French composer, also 19th century, like Jules Massenet from earlier. He wrote this huge work, Carnival of the Animals, written for this sort of interesting instrumentation, chamber orchestra with two pianos, percussion, harp, and it's each movement sort of embodies a different animal character. Mm-hmm. And so I'll do a little bit of the swan.
Great.
Because it's another one of those pieces I like to pull out and play for lots of different kinds of occasions. And yeah, I'll do the swan now.
I should go very quick. Yay!
Thank you.
That's a beautiful piece.
Thank you. Always safe for a Monday morning.
Right, I know. So as a independent music professional, what are some of the, I know I've had some very strange gigs at very strange times. What are the, if you feel okay talking about
it. Oh my goodness. I mean, so, I do have a short list going of notes from the last probably 5 to 6 years that I'm hoping to one day turn into a book because I've really seen it all.
Yeah.
I don't even know where to start with that one because it's like, what are the gigs that I've done that are like the highest stressed or like just the most out there or like the most like crazy or whatever? Oh my goodness.
How about one? Like, imagine you're playing and you're looking around and you're like, how did I end up doing this? Like, good or bad? I'm sure you've had those. You're like, what?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely have had those moments. I think, well, I will say that it, well, part of my problem, probably not being able to remember them so much off the top of my head, is that I'm one of those people where I do so many performances.
Yes, I know you.
That, like, my brain sort of has this way of, like, compartmentalizing. And I'm like, as soon as that event is done, like, it sort of gets filed away in deep storage. And then, like, I'm literally only thinking about the next thing. So, like, in my inbox, when I have itineraries out for events, I have up everything for that day. And, like, as I'm leaving the one event to get to the next one, I archive, like with my thumb, I swipe it over. I'm, like, done, out of my mind. And then I'm thinking only about the next thing. And sometimes my... You know, people are like, what, so like, what'd you do this weekend? And I'm like, it's Monday. And I'm like, I don't know. Give me a minute to think about it. But like, I actually don't know the answer. It's truthful. I'm being completely truthful. So this is my problem. You know, I mean, I've seen, I love weddings. And I, if I tell people, if I could play a wedding every day, I would. I never get tired of them. And again, people think, oh, it's a wedding musician. Oh, you're just a wedding. No, it's so much fun. You are playing for the most important moment in someone's life oftentimes. And it's something you hope that they only do that once.
Yeah.
Right? And so it's really so monumental. And for some clients, it's like they've spent years dreaming of that moment and months, if not years, planning for it. And, you know, a bride never comes down the aisle in silence, right? Like, music is what facilitates it. So you really have such a special role to play at weddings. And I think I've just seen so many amazing ones. And people have come down the aisle in pink tutus, or people have gotten married in costumes, or in a backyard, or, you know, the top floor of Terminal Tower at the Ritz-Carlton, or in a park, or, you know, in someone's living room. And it's like, they're all just so great and fun and cool. And, you know, even in the pandemic, we've had a lot of clients move from 2020 to 2021 or 2022. So oddly enough, right now our schedule next year is already very full, but we also had a lot of clients still make a go of it. And they went from, you know, 300 people at the Hilton to 15 people in a backyard and only immediate family. And, you know, and then they had, I loved this summer, one of them, we did the backyard just for immediate family. And then all of their friends drove by in a car parade. And so they had, like, special permission from the police to, like, do, like, a little escort. So, like, 80 cars drove by their house.
Oh, wow.
We couldn't leave the wedding for, you know, we had to wait for the car line to finish. But it was so fun. And just the ways that people found to still be together, you know. And I respect everyone's choices with that, you know.
Yeah.
It's been an interesting year. So
speaking of finding a way to be together, you started something called Front Yard Concerts.
Yeah.
I want to say back in May. Is that right?
Yeah. The first ones as an ensemble were in May.
Okay.
I did a couple before that as a soloist. So obviously when the pandemic hit, it was traumatizing to, again, like, I find so much value in this career that I've built. You know, we've already talked about this independent career. I take pride in my work and was so excited for the year ahead. You know, usually January, February, March, you're just, you can't wait for it to pick up.
Yeah.
I mean, there are still things in the winter months that you do and it's fun. But, man, like, I love that pace of the busy season. And you know, the pandemic hit right as we were coming into it. You know, from St. Patrick's Day to Easter is still sort of usually a slowish time. And then, boom, it's, like, straight until Halloween. And then you have the holidays. And so kind of watching my inbox every morning cancel, 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 postpone, postpone, postpone. And it was, like, so heartbreaking. Financially, and, you know, as a parent of, I have two kids, my husband is also self-employed as a business owner, and we are, you know, no paid time off, all of those things, sort of like the anxiety was real. And I don't like to be too vocal about that stuff on social media, like my personal life. You know, everyone makes their choices about how they do that. But I had posted about how difficult this was, and a neighbor who's a friend reached out and said, hey, I'm going to Venmo you right now. And I want you to wait until the weather's warm enough and just come show up and play in my front yard. And I was like, oh my gosh, thank you so much. You know, I'd love that. And she lives on a really tight-knit block on in our neighborhood of, like, all the neighbors know each other. And so I'd say 2 or 3 weeks went by, and I realized we had, like, a random warm day where it was, like, 60.
Yeah.
You know, it's like Cleveland spring, and so, you know, sad. And there's, like, one day where I saw the high was going to be 60, and I texted her. Her name's Emily. I said, Emily, like, it's noon. Like, it's going to be 60 degrees. I can be there at 4 o'clock. You want me to play at 4? And I asked my husband to just come home from work a little early so he could watch the girls while I jetted over there. And I played on her tree lawn, and like every single person came out and sat on their porch because everyone was still working at home and all the kids were home. And then people like from farther down the block walked down, and just watching people's, like, there was so much emotional stress pent up for people. Some people hadn't like hardly been out of their houses at all. And just coming out to that experience was so moving and powerful. And it made it on Facebook, like what, like the Gabe Pollock, who runs the Bop Stop.
Was
actually a neighbor of neighbor. And ended up like live streaming the whole thing on his phone, blasted it to Bop Stop. And so it was viewed like 5,000 times, and all of these, there was just this huge response of support and interest. And then suddenly someone I didn't even know, well, someone else I knew contacted me, said, can you come do that in my front yard? And then someone else said, can do that in my front yard. And then in early May, they said, someone said, hey, can your ensemble come? And we hadn't gotten together in the shutdown at all. And so we were a little nervous at first. Obviously, there's all this data now about outdoor performances being safe. But at the time, not a lot of that was available. We just weren't sure what the right thing to do was. And we decided to do one. And again, I mean, it was like they all just built onto each other, like the literal snowball analogy that people were impacted. And so we decided to make it a thing. We made it purely pay what you can. We didn't do a pricing sheet or contracts the way that we do. It's like crazy to think I did over 90 events this summer with no contracts. But it left the door open for both parties if circumstances changed health-wise or, you know, climate or weather even. You know, we were completely dependent on the weather. And I'm really proud to say that, well, not proud, it's not like I had anything to do with the weather, but we only had to move two or three of them all summer because of weather. Wow. So we really hit, I mean, there was some effing hot days. I had to think if I'm allowed to cuss on a podcast. There were some hot days. The hottest days that I could, that I've had to play outside. And you know, it's so funny, as a musician, you're usually so stressed out with outdoor events.
Yes.
You know, I was just talking about weddings. I love playing weddings, but man, outdoor weddings can be really stressful because the, you know, clients want exactly what they want that day. But, you know, if it's just a little bit drizzly, well, that bride still wants to walk down the aisle, but your violin can't be outside. You know, but man, like, but outdoors was what it was like. That was our only way to survive this summer. And so we just bucked it up. I mean, we never allowed our instruments to get wet, but we definitely played in much hotter temperatures than we normally would. They survived. You know, our violins were built. My violin was built before climate control. Right. Yeah. So like at the end of the day, yes, you need to take care of it. But we often forget that like these instruments have survived centuries without.
Yeah.
You know,
how old is your violin?
My violin is pretty young. It's only 1925. So it's almost 100. It's 95. But some members of my ensemble have instruments well over a century and into the 19th century. And so I want to be careful.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I use a carbon fiber bow. It's $300, made in China. It's not fancy. Again, because I can drop it. It can get whacked at an event. It doesn't. And because it's carbon fiber and not wood, it's not as sensitive to temperature changes.
Oh, okay.
So it's just a little bit more durable. And I mean, I can play on it.
Yeah.
I have a nicer boat at home, but this is just fine. And but anyway, so we did 90 of them, and you know, our smallest audience was an audience of two.
Aww.
You know, in a front yard in Beechwood for a wedding anniversary, and they just wanted to find a way to make it special.
Yeah.
And we had, you know, upwards of 100 people scattered across several lawns, you know, in like the big Edgewater neighborhood or something. And well, the host home actually owned a sound system and so hooked us into it so that we could be heard farther and people could spread out. And it's so funny, like some people had us back out to their neighborhood two or three times. And some people contacted us at the end of the season and said, we want to do this next year, even without the pandemic.
Nice.
Like, you know, we're going to fundraise with our Black Club to just make sure this happens. And we saw people gather with people that they hadn't seen in person in 6 months, or grandparents came over just for that concert. And it was really moving. It was this way, this crazy way to build community. And it seemed so simple. And like, it's not that, it wasn't rocket science what we were doing. But it really served that appetite for connection.
Yeah.
And it was a good reminder, you know, some people are like, oh, do you guys do albums? Do you do this or that? Do you stream? Do you tour? It was like, no, like I love being here. I love being in my community, finding ways to share what I do where I am. And here at the end of the year, we feel like we made 90 more friends.
Yeah.
You know, it's like crazy how it happened.
That's so cool.
And we remarkably, in a year that has been very isolating for many people, we have felt just an enormous amount of love and support. So I feel privileged and grateful, and I recognize that it's not how everyone has lived this. Mm-hmm. And so I just feel like I should acknowledge that, yeah.
Thank you. Would you play one of the pieces that you do for those concerts?
Yeah, sure. Well, let's see. So we said we were allowed to do a little pop and...
Yeah.
Okay, cool. I was trying to think of, like, which Beatles song would be best without my colleagues. I'll do a little bit of In My Life.
Nice.
Classic.
Yeah.
There's a little harpsichord solo in the middle I think I can whip out without my cellist, at least. Again, close enough for the Beatles.
Makes me think about, I was thinking about songs, like good songs can jump from style to style in some ways, right? Mm-hmm. Or reinterpretation, mm-hmm. if they're good pieces, right?
Yeah.
And it's like people are like, what's good music? Like, well, often it's what do you like, mm-hmm. you know?
Yep.
But if you're thinking about something that stands the test of time, it's literally something that stands the test of time and survives different ways of being done, mm-hmm. and good hook, if you want to talk about pop stuff, right?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Good melody.
It's all it takes sometimes.
Yeah, right?
Totally. And I don't even, like, oh my gosh, I get so tired of, like, conversations qualifying certain classical music as, like, the greatest music of all time. Or, like it starts to bug me now when people are like, Bach, you know, he's the greatest composer of all time or whatever. It's like, well, like, most of the people alive on the planet at this moment haven't heard Bach. Or, I mean, many of them haven't.
Yeah.
And to them, music is something that's great, that's different.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so subjective. And I love that my partner, my husband that I married, is a musician.
Mm-hmm.
Not professionally as, like, a career, but he did have a stint in professional settings. And but he gave me my Bob Dylan, Beatles, you know, Tom Petty education. And we watched the documentaries on The Wrecking Crew and Sun Studios and all of these, like, other really, I mean, just as important stories. And so I truly, and this is true, I see all genres as equal, mm-hmm. in the sense that like Bob Dylan is just as valid as Bach,
yeah.
for different reasons,
yeah.
for different people, different moment in time. And his music is just as influential in many ways. And so, like, any sort of conversations of quantifying something as better than something else or whatever, like, I got no time for that. you know, that's one reason when we do our concerts, I try to program Gershwin plus Bach plus Bob Dylan plus improvising plus our cellist right stuff. And we don't make a big fuss about putting it all side to side to side.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't always have to be a concert of just French music or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
I think there's something to be said for people. Sometimes people are willing to tune in because we're playing something popular culturally, like 20th century pop.
Mm-hmm.
But then they hear this piece by Bach or this piece by Beethoven. They're like, oh, that was the best thing. Like, or, you know, to them, like this new experience.
Mm-hmm.
And then same thing, some of these people that will follow us because we play great classical music will end up hearing jazz from the 20s or something and be like, oh my gosh, that really hit me.
Yeah.
And so by mixing the two together, you end up kind of cross-populating people who love both, you know, you turn this listener into someone who loves this too. And I mean, whatever, it's all great. So.
Yeah. Cool. Yay. I would love to have you play at least two more pieces.
Mm-hmm.
What would you...
I was thinking... as I was stumbling through the harpsichord solo in my life just now, that I think another sort of signature that we did this summer was we always played Gershwin's Summertime.
Okay.
It's a classic.
Yes.
And what I love, fun fact, is I think you recently, did you have Marshall Griffith in here?
Yeah, just Friday.
Friday?
Yeah.
And when I was a student at CIM, Marshall taught the jazz improv course,
mm-hmm.
which I think he still teaches there. And I took it. And this was one of the pieces that you sort of learn to improvise with.
Okay.
And I still sort of use the version that I got as his student. So I love that he was here because I sort of credit his course with teaching me so much on how to sort of let loose. But I'll do a little bit of Summertime.
Okay, great.
Since it's almost winter.
Yeah. So, listening to that, I hear almost like both the jazz, you know, where it comes from, the Gershwin, but like a little bit of Russian influence. I don't know where that came, like it just popped into my head. I could be like completely like off base about that.
Huh.
Like
Wait.
A real Russian classical tinge of something. I don't know.
Well, I'm sort of like, I feel like I have this sound where I have my comfort zone of certain ways that I use glissando or vibrato. Uh-huh. That, it's so funny. One of my students' moms, who studied music as a child, but she's not a professional musician or anything, she looked at me in the lesson one day and she was like, "You have a very identifiable sound." And I had to think about that for a while. I was like, I wonder what she means by that. But you might just be hearing some of the little idioms, the ways that I play things.
Yeah. Well,
and that's the other thing too, is when we talk, I sort of have, I think sometimes this strange or at least less common artist mindset where, not that I'm not there to serve the art or the music exactly how a composer wanted it, but I also think it's okay to just play things like however the hell you want it. You know, like, if that's okay to say, just play it the way you want to play it. Like, there are 100,000 recordings of music by Bach.
Mm-hmm.
Why do I need to be another violinist playing it just as authentically?
Yeah.
I mean, it's important to know the context of how it was performed at the time. Give yourself some a palette to work with and to think on, but like, why do I need to play it that way? There's no reason.
No.
With Gershwin, like, why do I need to sound exactly like people from that era or in the style that he would have wanted? I mean, like, you know, anyway, so sometimes I get into these situations, I think, where I can be criticized for that a little bit, or people don't always agree with that approach either, which is fine, whatever, you know, however you're looking to hear it, go hear it.
That's their problem. I mean, there is, you know, in classical, there's that sort of straight and narrow path that they've sort of widened more recently with the rise of focused careers, and out of necessity, there are only, you know, so many people coming out of conservatory every year. There are not that many orchestra jobs or opera jobs or whatever.
Yeah.
You simply cannot. There's no place.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Even if you're amazing. Yeah. There are so many, like you, many amazing musicians here in Cleveland alone. There are not the jobs of that very particular narrow kind for all those people.
Yeah.
So we have to do something else and often really enjoy. Not so we have to, we choose to.
Yeah.
But I think we share a lot of the same mindset. Mm-hmm. Like when I was coming up through opera, they're like, you really need to do this and nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, but I like comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And I like kind of like the acting thing and some straight plays sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I think it's in general, in the performing arts, just across the board, I think there is a big shift right now.
Yes.
People are recognizing, I mean, in 2020, a professional career, even for orchestral players. I mean, during the pandemic, the musicians of the Cleveland Orchestra have gotten really creative to create some of their digital programming and, do some really out-of-the-box stuff. So even the orchestra, quote-unquote, orchestra career is not now what it was.
Yeah.
I mean, even when I was in school 10, 15 years ago. So, we're not in Kansas anymore. Like, you know, just get on the boat or be left behind, whatever. It's, you know, or, you know, find your own way. If you want to keep on with, you know, the old school track, it's totally fine too. Again, I'm like, I'm not here to judge anyone's choices, but I think it's really important to make sure musicians coming out of studies also understand that there are, you know, many musicians that don't even go that path, that are full of insight and wisdom and experience and great artistry. There's no one path. But for those who are in it, it's important for us to show all of the options and to leave it open for people to find themselves.
Here's a lantern. Here are many choices, or you can make up your own.
Totally.
Go enjoy. So what else would you like for us to hear today?
At the time of this broadcast, is holiday appropriate, or
Try to get it out sometime in the next couple of weeks. We could do Hanukkah, or as I know you were doing.
I'll do one more sort of Irish Scottish tune that's appropriate for the new year. I'll play Auld Lang Syne. That's a good piece to close
perfect.
With.
Okay.
And it, I think it's a good piece for 2020 because You're lifting a cup and drinking to those you want to remember, those you're not with. And I think that's a big message for this year. There's lots of things this week. My mother-in-law turns 70. One of my daughters turns 4, and my own mom turns 60. And oh, I don't know if she'd want me to say that on a podcast. How old she'll be? No, it's fine. It's fine. She'll just think it's funny that I said it. But don't tell people how old I am. No, but and unfortunately, those are all special milestones, and we can't celebrate them the way that we want to celebrate them, and it's frustrating and all of those things. But we just have to keep thinking about next year and we do all the things we can right now so that we can be together again. Mm-hmm. So I'll play Auld Lang Syne. That seems right. My rogue E.
Listeners can't see this right now, but I've got my hands clasped over my heart because I was like, you're bringing a lot of joy. Thank you.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I think that feels like a good place to, I don't want to say stop, but pause, and we'll see you again sometime
soon. Yeah, totally. Let's do it again.
So
when we don't have to have our, when I can actually wear a lip gloss.
Yeah, we're both got our masks on. Yeah. And, yeah, learning to speak clearly
right,
through the fabric.
Yeah.
So thank you, Ariel Clayton Karas, for joining us today.
Yes.
And if people want to find you online, where should they go?
Yeah, on Facebook and Instagram, we're at Opus216. Mm-hmm. And then we have a website, opus216.com, and a blog, opus216.wordpress.com. Send me a message, smoke signal, whatever, from those places. And it's usually me answering. And I would love to hear from people. And again, we're always looking for new ways to share music. And I hope in my career, I have thousands more opportunities to do that. So, yeah.
I am sure you will. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Liz. Thank you, guys.
Thank you for listening to And Now the Music from Audio Recording Studio in Cleveland. Your host has been Liz Huff. Audio production was by Bruce Gigax. Theme music written by Ryan Charles Raymer. I'm Randall Fusco. This has been a Notes to Music production.